Hi, this is Dr. Ronald Hoffman. As we age, forestalling and even reversing bone loss becomes more and more important. That's why I've created the Intelligent Medicine Bone Health Protocol, my personal supplement recommendations to ensure your skeletal health. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com. In addition to the Bone Health Protocol, you'll find easy-to-follow links for my Supplement Starter Kit, Heart Health Protocol, and much more. These new protocols are an easy way for you to get the exact combination of targeted supplements you need to help you follow the Intelligent Medicine lifestyle, and for a limited time, you'll get free shipping on all of your store orders. For more details, just go to drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking to Dr. David Perlmutter, who's a board-certified neurologist, author of Grain Brain, and a really remarkable thing about my good colleague, Dr. Perlmutter, who I've known for, too many decades to enumerate, is his wonderful ability to communicate ideas, both at a very, very sophisticated scientific level. He's lectured at top universities and to many, many conferences of integrative physicians and neurologists, as well as getting the message across on popular venues such as the Dr. Oz Show and CBS Early Show. And he is also the originator and star of a program that's available on PBS, Dr. Perlmutter's Whole Life Plan. And you did a really great job getting the word out in an understandable, actionable way. So tell us about that series.
Well, I'd like to. So Public Television was gracious enough to allow me to create this new program. And I'm not sure when it, March, April, May, June, airs in June. And it really kind of just empowers the viewer that, hits the ball across the net into their court. Because they, individuals need to take control and start making changes. For our most dreaded conditions, we really don't have any good therapeutic options for things like Alzheimer's, for example, and even Parkinson's. You know, there are medications to treat symptoms, but actually treating the underlying disease process, and when it comes to that, we are empty-handed in terms of mainstream medicine. So it's really about empowering individuals with knowledge that, things like artificial sweeteners that you think are a good choice are a bad choice because they are associated with a dramatic increased risk for diabetes and obesity. And now we have found new research published in the journal Stroke that, for example, artificial sweeteners are associated with a threefold increased risk for Alzheimer's disease.
Whoa.
And that is breathtaking.
Yeah.
Things like proton pump inhibiting drugs, which according to a recent publication in the Journal of the American Medical Association, are associated with a 42% increased risk of dementia as well. So, my mission and my outreach, whether it's in books or podcasts with Dr. Hoffman or public television, is to let people hear the other side of the story, that what marketing geniuses are coming up with may not be in your interest, it's more in their interest, that these commercials and the bombardment of our Facebook sites, for example, with ads targeted at you are not in your interest. They're in their bottom line interest. So, it's very important that people hear the other side of this story. For example, a new study came out in the journal Neurology in March of 2018. The study was called Midlife Cardiovascular Fitness and Risk and Dementia. And what they did was they looked at about 1,500 women who were age late 30s to early 60s, and they examined these women way back in 1968 and determined their level of cardiovascular fitness. They put them on an ergonomic exercise cycle and determined how in shape they were. Then they let them go. And then they followed these women up, 30 years later, actually 2012, and they determined who became demented and who didn't. And what they found, I think, was really quite dramatic, that in this group, the risk of dementia in those who had the highest level of cardiovascular fitness years ago was reduced by 88% in comparison to those who had average level of fitness. The number of individuals in the high level of cardiorespiratory fitness way back in 1968, the percentage of individuals who developed full-blown Alzheimer's was 0%.
Oh, now, my goodness. Wow. I mean, if they ever developed a drug like that, I mean, if they could put that in a bottle.
It's published in our most well-respected peer-reviewed journal. And the first thing is that people who are perhaps maybe think that they're a little bit young to be thinking about Alzheimer's, anything but reality, that our choices in midlife and even earlier, because the relationship held for even people who are younger, that these choices are really very, very important. That we set the stage by the choices we make early on in life with respect to late life risk. And again, I'm going to repeat it, we're talking about risk for a disease that has no treatment. And, you know, it's all about prevention. And nobody seems to want to talk about prevention of Alzheimer's disease. The other thing that the takeaway from this study is it was done in women. And I think, you know, your listeners should know that two-thirds of Alzheimer's patients are women. No one really likes to talk about that. I think the Me Too movement should embrace that statistic and really ask the medical community to shine some light on that and really help to understand why that might be.
David, I'd like to do a little bit of a lightning round with you on the subject.
We've done this before.
Yeah,
these questions are worth twice value now, right?
Exactly.
Double point value. Okay,
yeah,
go.
It's like we're in the second round of Jeopardy here. Looking at some of the important components of a comprehensive lifestyle program for Alzheimer's prevention and reversal. So are you with me? Let's go. Sleep.
I don't know how I'm going to rank it, but fundamentally important. What is really interesting is a study that came out in December of last year that showed, actually, interestingly enough, there's a sweet spot. We know that interrupted sleep, a non-fulfilling sleep, is profoundly associated with increased risk for Alzheimer's disease. In fact, in the public television program, I dedicate quite a bit to talking about that, recommending that individuals undergo a sleep study to determine, are they getting restorative sleep? Having said that, a new study, as I mentioned, came out that indicates that, in fact, anything above 9 hours actually is on the opposite side of that bell curve and is also associated, well, actually it would be a U-shaped curve, is actually associated with increased risk for dementia. So the sweet spot seems to be 7 to 9 hours.
I'm right. I hit it right perfectly last night. 7.5
Good.
Hours.
That's great. Why you're so sharp today.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it could be the dark chocolate that I had before this. Is it? Could that play a role?
I mean, today.
Any day. Any day is a good day for dark chocolate.
I think we're seeing some cases of reflux from having dark chocolate at night as your dessert from your evening meal. But I'm all in during the day. You know, 80 to 85% cacao or higher. That means lower sugar, so it's a little bit more bitter. I mean, you know, Baker's chocolate is certainly almost intolerable, but lots of good polyphenols for your antioxidant coverage, but also, more importantly, I believe, your gut bacteria are loving your polyphenols that you're getting from the red wine.
It's a prebiotic.
Chocolate, and a good choice.
Yeah. Okay, so continuing our lightning round, stress or counter-stress measures like meditation.
All very, very important. I think you're hitting the high points. Again, I'm not sure where I would rank it, but it's at the top, many of the list, the top maybe five. We live in a stressful world, and day in and day out, this chronic stress is having effects that play into some of the other choices. Changing our desire to remain on a good diet, making us not want to exercise as much, certainly interrupting our speech. But even more directly, stress secreting various chemicals like cortisol that are directly damaging to the brain's hippocampus, but also indirectly damaging because of the effects of that stress hormone, cortisol, on the gut in terms of changing the array of bacteria that live there and also leading to increased leakiness of the gut, which is the cornerstone of inflammation and may very well have a role to play in things like Alzheimer's disease.
Indeed. And you jumped the gun to my next lightning round subject, which is the microbiome, you know, an altered microbiome. It turns out there actually have been some good studies looking at the relationship between the microbiome and Parkinson's disease, possibly also Alzheimer's.
That's right. We have seen a lot of interesting studies indicating that Parkinson's may actually have its genesis in the gut, which Chinese medicine told us 2,000 years ago if we were listening. But that said, it is very exciting to see that you know, the abnormal protein, this alpha-synuclein protein that accumulates in the Parkinsonian brain, may actually have its origin in the gut. When we see statistics that show, for example, that people years ago in ulcer treatment had their vagus nerve cut, that used to be a treatment, oddly enough, for ulcers. Yep. They have what's called a vagotomy and pyloroplasty. Mm-hmm. They'd have the vagus nerve cut, that their risk for Parkinson's is significantly lower. Hmm. So it's now thought that the vagus nerve acts as a highway, allowing this alpha-synuclein protein to make its way from the gut into the brain. I think that's fascinating. But more importantly, I think we understand that there are changes seen in the array of bacteria in the gut that seem to correlate with Parkinson's risk, certainly Alzheimer's risk. Ongoing studies right now trying to correlate the changes in the array of bacteria to Lou Gehrig's disease, and the data that correlates bacterial changes in the gut to autism is perhaps the most robust data out there in terms of relating the gut to the brain. That said, I'm editing a new medical textbook that'll be out in the fall of 19 called, oddly enough, The Microbiome and the Brain. And we have contributing authors from, my goodness, MIT, Harvard, Oxford, UCLA, University of British Columbia, all leaders, world leaders in particular areas who are going to contribute and really try to bring, you know, a state-of-the-art message, at least to healthcare providers.
Okay, continuing our lightning round, let's talk about the impact of alcohol. You know, it's been advocated that some people drink, you know, a few glasses of Pinot Noir every week. Good, bad for the brain?
The data that relates alcohol consumption, I think, is a bit puzzling because it oftentimes looks at alcohol consumption in general compared to things like dementia risk. And I think that is a bit unfair because it doesn't segregate out the Pinot versus the scotch or the beer or other sources of alcohol. And I think that's actually very important because what we do note is that there are more than 800 different polyphenols in a glass of red wine, 800 different types. So there's an upside. Is there a downside to the alcohol and the brain that is not even dose dependent? And I'd say yes, there is. So I think that lower levels of alcohol consumption in general are probably a good idea. The good news is that we're seeing wines being developed with much lower carb content, rather sugar content, organic, and with lower alcohol content. So you get the benefits, minimize the risk. I think there's an upside. I think one glass of red wine a day is a good idea, all in all, based upon what we learned from the research that is out there. You know, Dr. Hoffman, it's sort of like the studies that would conclude that eating meat is a bad thing.
Yeah.
We look at books like the China study that conclude that eating meat is a bad thing, that by and large, eating meat will increase your risk for a number of things, including colon cancer. Do I agree with that? Absolutely. I think it's absolutely true. I think that by and large, eating meat is a bad choice, eating red meat. That doesn't mean that those studies looked at, for example, the idea of eating grass-fed, organically raised meat in comparison to factory-farmed meat. That's huge. It's like the alcohol story, you know, looking at scotch versus a good red wine. Mm-hmm. So, by and large, people eat meat that shouldn't be consumed. It's very risky food. But then again, there are sources of meat people get involved with, and source out and get some really high quality meat that's good for you, that doesn't have those risks.
Indeed.
Now, that wasn't one of your lightning round questions, but I get extra credit, I hope.
Exactly. You turn it into an essay question. Very good job. Lately, there have been some revelations about a whole raft of drugs that are bad, especially for seniors to take when it comes to their cognitive performance. Now, you mentioned PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, that cause malabsorption of certain nutrients, mess up the microbiome. Are there others that should, under all circumstances, be avoided if possible?
Well, I'm not going to say that any drug under all circumstances should be avoided. You know, we talk about the dangers, for example, of antibiotics, as to get back to the gut bacteria. The dangers of proton pump inhibitors. I think under all circumstances they should not be avoided, but under most circumstances they should. There's clearly a time and a place for an antibiotic, for example, but they're dramatically overused. They're used in raising cattle, in raising poultry. They're given out like candy in clinics for people who have a sniffle or a sore throat, or children who pull on their ears. So I think that the World Health Organization would indicate that perhaps two-thirds of the antibiotics, rather the CDC, not the World Health Organization, that two-thirds of the antibiotics used in America are unnecessary. There's a variety of reasons why they're dangerous. Bacterial resistance is one, but dramatic changes in the microbiome, I think, may even outweigh that other risk. I think that as it relates to cognitive issues, we know that the second-generation antipsychotics have a risk of increasing cognitive decline. Certainly, the sedatives do as well.
Cholinergic medications.
Oh, that's right. And you know, those anticholinergic medications are commonly seen to cause significant cognitive change in adults. And these are given out frequently to men who have troubles with urinary function. So a variety of medications, I think, are under the gun. Probably the largest consumed medication now on the planet are the acid-blocking drugs, many of which in America are available over the counter. I mean, just ask Larry the Cable Guy. He's telling everybody they should be blocking stomach acid.
Yep.
And again, you know, published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Journal Neurology, that they put out, a recent study demonstrated that the chronic consumption of these proton pump inhibiting acid blocking drugs that people can get over the counter are associated with a 42% increased risk for dementia.
Whoa.
A situation for which there is no way out.
Yeah.
So my goodness, we've really got to, as John Kennedy said, you know, repair the roof while the sun is shining. And when people are still intact cognitively, we've got to really give them this information. That's the message here.
All right, I'll draw another card for the lightning round. Coffee.
You're drawing cards, I'm sure.
Coffee. What do you think about coffee and caffeine for the brain?
Good. And I think that coffee has been demonstrated to activate certain enzyme pathways. It acts as what we call a phosphodiesterase inhibitor, and as such, that has positive effects in the brain. New research indicates that coffee, 2 cups of coffee, has a pretty dramatic effect in terms of increasing the availability in the blood of chemicals that are called ketones, which are really, really good for the brain. Can there be a downside with respect to individuals getting nervous or maybe having some cardiac rhythm issues? Yes. Pregnant women should think twice perhaps about drinking a lot of coffee. But I would say overall, a cup of coffee, preferably black, or add in some MCT oil or coconut oil, is a good thing. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that a Frappuccino that has 76 grams of sugar in it is a good choice. That's not a cup of coffee. That doesn't allow you to relate back to the statistics I've just quoted.
It's a confection.
Absolutely. And as such, you know, you get it at a place that sells coffee. But, you know, don't kid yourself.
Okay. Hormones. You know, some things have been said about the role of hormone replacement therapy to protect the brain in women, estrogen, in men, testosterone, DHEA, pregnenolone. All these are up for their potential as cognitive enhancers.
It's a very, very difficult question to answer because, A, there has been a paucity of research that looks at it. Though there are some studies. And B, these studies look at a variety of types of interventions that may or may not be comparable. Meaning, Is it fair to compare the use of Premarin, conjugated horse urine-derived estrogen, with a naturally derived type of estrogen? What about comparing Provera, which is a synthetic form of progesterone, with naturally derived progesterone? Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of the studies use one or another or combinations, and they generally do not look at cognitive function in the near term. They look at risk for cognitive decline in the long term. I do believe that when hormone levels are assessed and there is a significant drop in or deficiency in one hormone in a male or a female, that bringing that hormone back up to a more reasonable level is probably the right thing to do. But you still run into issues with accuracy of the blood test versus urine test, the level of something called sex hormone binding globulin that has a role to play in the availability of that hormone in the bloodstream to then do its job. I'd say that is a very, very difficult question. I actually labored through this discussion even earlier today with someone. And I think we're still, you know, hoping for a literature that can give us direction.
Indeed. And one final consideration, this is kind of new and very au courant, topic of many conversations, is cannabinoids, CBD and related hemp-derived or marijuana-derived compounds for the brain.
Again, as you mentioned, it's certainly avant-garde. And I think that when we recognize that stimulation of certain cannabinoid receptors in the brain is associated with positive effects in terms of synaptic, the connection of brain cells to each other, and possibly even affecting neurogenesis, the growth of new brain cells, I think that's very interesting and certainly calls us to further research this. We always, again, wonder, might there be downsides of being overzealous and trying to stimulate one unique endocannabinoid receptor by developing a product that could do that? I think that what we're seeing is a widespread usage of CBD oil, other preparations of CBD that are available now in many states, without any real good consideration as to what might downsides be both acutely and long-term in the capricious use of these products in terms of stimulating certain receptors that have not been fully characterized. For example, we know that there are cannabinoid receptors in the gut that regulate either gut permeability when they're stimulated or gut healing, reducing gut permeability. Mm-hmm. And that's a very important concept that we won't have time to talk about today, but we should be considering all aspects of what we do. Again, above all, do no harm. We've got to do a lot of research before we're able to say we're going to make a recommendation, you know, to stimulate a certain receptor because it's good for the brain. Yes, there are derivatives that are good for nausea, that are helpful in pain management, that are good, that are worthwhile to use in cancer patients who have nausea associated with chemotherapy, that are, you know, helpful for anxiety. Certainly the research that relates the usage of some of these derivatives in intractable epilepsy in children is profound. You've got to pay attention to that. And, you know, in a situation like that, you sort of are much more lenient to move ahead and use one of these derivatives. But I think we're early in the game, and we want to watch as the science expands itself.
Indeed. Well, you really aced the lightning round. It's an enormous amount of information in a very short
When's
time.
When's Final Jeopardy coming?
Exactly. Well, you know, that'll be next week. We'll bring it back.
And I get to prepare for it.
you're clearly today's winner. And for our listening audience, you know, I want to really provide my wholehearted endorsement to Dr. Perlmutter's resources that are available on the internet. Also, a wonderful newsletter, and you do great videos. How can people access those?
Well, my website, oddly enough, is drperlmutter.com. drperlmutter.com. Who knew?
And spell it. Because
I think that's probably the best place to start.
It's P-R-L.
Because that's where you can get... I write a newsletter every week that goes out to all of our people who follow us. All of our videos are there under the Empowering Neurologist. They're also on iTunes. They're on YouTube. It's all about, you know, for me, getting in, like it is for you, just getting information out. There it is. And that's my job. And, you know, for the viewers and listeners, you know, that hits, as I mentioned, hits the ball to your side of the court. Now you got an easy shot to return. You just got to make it happen.
Absolutely. And we're in the same line of work for sure, getting the word out. So the new book coming out is going to be an update of the Grain Brain.
That's right. Grain Brain, a 5-year anniversary. Who knew? And then in probably late 19 or early 2020, I have a new book, title of which is not yet determined. We're going to call it The Happy Brain for now. But it's all about reconnecting to that part of the brain that can make, you know, for goodness, that allows you to be empathetic as opposed to narcissistic. And we can do that. We have the tools that can allow you to do that, to disengage from the way our brains have been hacked by media and marketing. And I'm really excited that I'm writing that book along with my son, Austin Perlmutter, MD. Hmm. And to reconnect with my son on that level is also very, very exciting.
I see another bestseller in the making. So all the best in that worthy enterprise. Thank you very much, Dr. David Perlmutter, for joining us. It's really been a pleasure.
And thank you, Dr. Hoffman. Always a pleasure.
Okay. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.